Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 169 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on the working class-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. Please stop by crmw.net. That's Coal River Mountain Watch. See for yourself what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day, today being Tuesday, July 29, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Tuesday, July 29, 2008, you're listening to a live show, and you're welcome to call in and participate or join us in chat. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and at strictlyconfidentialradio.com you'll find out about the links to all of the guests and to the audio archives from all the past shows, which are graciously archived by Mr. Ben Birch over at White Rose Society. The past shows are all linked there at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You'll find links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. And you'll also find there a link to the Head On Radio Network main site. That's headonradionetwork.com. And it's the main site that you can find out about the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I am only a very small part. You'll find there at headonradionetwork.com also the PayPal button to make it easier for you to support work and help pay for all of the things it takes to keep the horn doing what it does so well, which is to provide you with progressive alternative radio, some of the smartest people on the planet. If you'd like to join in this evening, it's a Just Us show, by the way. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates to 877-443-2366. That's toll-free to West Virginia. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that. It's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. Rings in West Virginia, or we're glad to take your toll-free call at 877-443-2366. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. I do try to check the mail during the breaks. I also should point out that at strictlyconfidentialradio.com, you're going to find links to the chat room. The chat room is active, and I'm a part of it. And you can communicate with the show by the chat room. It's easy to get to and easy to register. You just click on the chat link there at strictlyconfidentialradio.com, choose yourself a chat name, and you're in. It is that simple, and we're glad to have you. So, irregular day here. I had what could be referred to as the Great Java Meltdown of 2008. It's been melting down for a while now, but today it finally, there is no combination of reinstalling Java or rolling back that will fix it, so it will take more time than I had this afternoon to unravel what is up with Java and the Head On Radio Network chat room, although it works beautifully on my laptop. So I'm chatting on two keyboards, or actually using two keyboards and two mouses this evening, which is always a challenge for me. I invariably grab the wrong one to do the wrong thing, so there may be some awkward moments this evening. I'm a creature of habit. I normally have everything, all the windows arranged on the screen exactly where I'd normally see everything, so I could pretty much just think about what I'm talking about during the course of the show and not think about windows and such. But now there's more than one screen, and it's just kind of scary here. But nonetheless, we are forging on, Java or no Java, and all is good. I want to point out to you that we do have tonight is just us. Tomorrow evening there will be a guest. It's Mr. John Simpson. And John Simpson will be our second writer, author of gay fiction, or gay romance novels / gay fiction. He will join us at 9 p.m. tomorrow evening. Next week we'll have music guests that have been set up by Mr. Glenn Rivera, who is our executive director of talent bookings. And I believe next week we have Amuka on the show. Amuka will be joining us, I believe it is August the 7th, if that's next Wednesday, I believe it is. Next Thursday, rather, August the 7th, she will be joining us. And you probably don't know her as Amuka, but I'll be telling you more about that as we get closer to the show date. Want to thank Bob for covering so well what happened in Knoxville. It is a difficult subject. As far as I can tell, it is the first act of outright terrorism specifically directed at liberals and gays, at least stated so. There are hate crimes, to be sure. It's the first act of terrorism that I can think of in any case. When you consider that the definition of terrorism is a systematic use of terror as a means of coercion, and most definitions refer to it that acts that are intended to create fear and are perpetrated for an ideological goal and deliberately target or disregard the safety of, quote, non-combatants, end quote. I think you'll be hard-pressed to find anyone, with the exception of the progressive community and this network and the various progressive blogs, who are actually calling it what it is, terrorism. Bob is, of course, completely correct, pointing out that had it been a Muslim who had pulled that trigger, or had it been a black man who had pulled that trigger, it would be all over it with the word terrorism. But a white man whose food stamps were running out or being reduced, who was desperate and brainwashed, is not called terrorism. I think if we are calling it a hate crime, that's being acknowledged at this point, but it goes so far beyond that. There's been a lot of coverage on this. The for-profit media has dodged in and out on the topic. It will be gone in a day or two, I would think. I don't think it will have the stickiness that we see when there's a school shooting or what have you. And I'm going to attempt to give you some alternative information that perhaps has not been covered by the shows that you've been hearing. Nonetheless, there will be, of course, repeated information. It's the story is so involved, it's hard not to. I think I'll begin with Carla Lewis. Now, Carla Lewis is a member of the Tennessee Transgender Political Coalition. And Carla often attends church services as well as various group meetings that the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church in Knoxville so freely offers its building to, for all sorts of LGBT, transgendered, questioning sort of events. She tells the story from a firsthand account of the shooting at the church. It begins by saying that Jamie and I, meaning Carla, were running late to the church that Sunday morning, and that's a usual thing. It always takes me too long to get there, and driving to the church, I was wondering if I really wanted to go. I liked the sermons and I liked the lectures about society and about philosophy. But this one was going to be a children's musical program, and I just didn't know if that was really for me. She walked up to the breezeway of the church. It has an opening in the middle that leads to a foyer for the sanctuary. The entrance is split, so you can enter through the double doors to the right or to the left. And the sun was especially bright that morning, so she and Jamie decided to go in on the left side. Started to walk in as the production was underway. We're quickly pulled back by John. And John is the man who took the first fire from the terrorist who attacked those gays and liberals who are, and I quote, destroying American society one institution at a time. John Bosted. We were asked to stand by the door and to see ourselves right after the first act because the play had already begun. Now, Carla indicates she's hard of hearing, and Jamie and I walked to the main foyer door, and he motioned us back. And as we walked back to the sanctuary, Carla says she noticed someone behind me. And in her mind, now recalling the events, she keeps telling herself, or she's sure that that was the shooter. However, at the time, she paid very little attention and didn't give it a second look. Those of you who have been following the story know that the play that was in progress there at the Unitarian Church was a version of Annie, the musical. And the Annie character was just finishing the song, Maybe the Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow, That's Your Bottom Dollar. And I was thinking, this is really good. The Miss Hannigan character walked in stage left and slapped the basket Annie was holding out of her hand. And from the sanctuary right entrance, I thought I heard a yell and then a loud boom. Explosions. Well, Carla tried to register in her mind to put it into context and was thinking, what was that? Did a speaker explode? Did I hear a prop in the play? Was it a prop gun? Did something go wrong? And as soon as she was able to think that thought, as soon as it was fully processed in her head, she smelled the sulfur from the gunpowder, and she heard another boom, and then another boom. Carl let go of Jamie's hand and stepped around the corner just as John, the large man who stood in the way of the attacker at the very beginning. He tackled the shooter. Immediately, two others were on top of him. As the shooter hit the ground, the shotgun shells went everywhere. The gun landed upside down against a bag or some other object on the floor. She saw that there was a shell halfway in the ejection port. It didn't look like it had been shot, so he may have been trying to shove a shell straight into the chamber and take another shot. Carla doesn't know much about firearms, neither do I. It seemed like an eternity, but it was only a few seconds, and Jamie and I were grabbed by several church members and pulled into a room. I opened the door to look out, and someone yelled at me to get back on the floor. I couldn't. I grabbed Jamie's hand, and we went through the foyer and out the back door. In the minutes leading up to when the police arrived, Jamie and I saw children with escorts looking for their parents. We saw children with adults with blood on their clothes. We saw the worst side of human cruelty we have ever seen. We knew people had been shot, but we did not know who. We eventually gathered with the rest of the church family on a hill behind the sanctuary. Most of the children were safe. And they were safe over at the Second Presbyterian Church next door, which had had them go over there, the young people, the children. And while we were standing together, I noticed our friend. She's a transgender youth. She told us that Greg, her foster father, had been hit, which really brought it home, because just 2 weeks earlier, Greg McKendry and his wife Barbara and their trans foster child were at our home celebrating Jamie's birthday. I really liked Greg, and to think someone could hurt him was very, very troubling to me. She goes on to tell us that the police gathered everyone together in the fellowship hall to tell us what to expect. The police identified the type of witnesses they wanted and eventually dismissed everyone. As Jamie and I stood by the door, Barbara McKendry came walking by, and she stopped to give both of us a hug. And she said, "Greg got hit. He's dead." I said, "Oh, my God," and my heart just broke. And Jamie and I couldn't hold it together anymore. And how could this happen to a group of people as loving as the members of the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Church? I needed an answer. I had to know why. And today we found out why. When some of the contents of the killer's letter revealed, it was a supposed hatred for the liberal establishment and gays. And Carla says, yes, the church embraced gays and the entire LGBT community. And Jamie is the president of PFLAG, which meets at the Universalist Church, Unitarian Church, and with a group of local transgender people. Transgender people are everywhere, as we've come to discover on this show, even in Knoxville. And she said, "I just started a new organization which meets at the Unitarian Church." As a matter of fact, Jamie and I met at the church in October of 99 at a transgender support group. There's been a candlelight gathering that was planned for 7:30 last evening, which would have been Monday, at the neighboring church, the Knoxville Second Presbyterian Church. And Jamie and I arrived early for one of the debriefing sessions. The adults and the children were separated and broken off into rooms with about 10 or 15 people per room. And each room was facilitated by a counselor trained in crisis management. And that's the reason that Jamie and I went. After we went through on Sunday, after what we went through, we were having difficulty dealing with the sounds of the images we saw. And several others in the room were also dealing with survivor guilt. You won't hear survivor guilt mentioned in the for-profit media. Somewhere in the back of our minds, there was a part of us saying that we could have done something more than hide. In the larger picture, 6 or 7 seconds is a very short period of time, but when a man is unloading a shotgun into your church and into your friends and into the people you worship with, it can seem an eternity. The session was very, very helpful with the counselors, and it could have actually lasted longer, hours more. But the facilitators led us to the fellowship hall, where there was a light food, and dips and fruits were served, and many of the food items were provided by local restaurants. That would be important. I would assume that the members of the church were unable to pull it together to prepare food. Carl says, "I know the Red Cross was present, as well as the Helen Ross Center and many others. I saw Muslim women and Jewish men and women, and all were members of the host church, all busily working to make sure that the TVUUC were well accommodated Unitarians. And soon after that, we headed for a sanctuary, which quickly filled to capacity. An overflow room was opened, and soon it was full. And several clergy members spoke, including Chris Bruce, the leader of the Universal Unitarian Church, and also William Sinkford, who's the president of the Unitarian Universalist Associations of Congregation. And congregations, after the candlelight service, some of the youth that were performing Annie during the shooting broke out into the song Tomorrow, and it was heartbreaking to hear the kids singing the same song. It could not have been more appropriate, and it helped me realize that the sun would indeed come out tomorrow. So I expect at this point, We're going to take a short break so that I can gather my wits, and we'll continue with what the American Family Association has said about the terrorist attack in Knoxville. Bob, let's go to break, please.
Raised up on Midwestern dreams, only a few shall get, but everyone shall meet. I took my family's burden, strapped it to my chest, $200 and a kiss for luck, and I pointed my dreams west.
Church, I take it a little bit personally. I have experienced the kindness of the Unitarian Church. The Metropolitan Community Church in Tallahassee met there for many years. I have been to many services there for the Metropolitan Community Church that are held Sunday afternoons. Beautiful facility in Tallahassee, the Unitarians have. The Metropolitan Community Church now has its own building in Tallahassee, so it doesn't use the Unitarian Church any longer. However, there was no rent charged. The only thing that was asked was just put the chairs back where they were. Would you cave in should you need to rearrange for anything? Full use of the kitchen and the refrigerators and the the stoves and the sanctuary and the free run of the facility from the Unitarians. And I remember sitting there. It was a beautiful facility. I remember sitting there one Sunday evening as the sun was going down. It's surrounded, even though it's in the city of Tallahassee, it is surrounded by heavy woods. The lot is absolutely beautiful. You drive in from the main road there into a longer driveway than you would expect that winds so that the church is completely surrounded by trees. You would think the church was located in a forest. And I remember thinking to myself one evening, what if some nutcase in Tallahassee was hiding out there in the woods? You see, the Unitarian Church there is mostly glass and surrounded by glass, both behind the pulpit and the sides, too. It would be very easy for someone to hide in the woods and begin shooting. And I thought to myself, what a shame it is that I would even think something like that, to live in the United States in the 21st century, to even worry about something like that. And this worst nightmare of my own essentially happened at the Unitarian Church in Knoxville. Now, not everyone can log in and leave a comment at the American Family Association's One News Now site. You have to submit your comment, and then later it has to be approved by a moderator before it goes public. So one wonders what kind of comments earned the American Family Association's stamp of approval regarding their reposting of the Associated Press story of the Knoxville church shooting. Well, how about this one that was approved by the moderators at the American Family Association? The post goes, while this is a tragedy, the article may mislead those who are not familiar with the Unitarian. By the way, Unitarian is misspelled. While this tragedy, well, is a tragedy, the article may mislead those who are not familiar with the Unitarian non-religion. Unitarians are not Christians, and like all non-Christians, they are doing Satan's work. Only a non-Christian would say something like that at a time like this. Thanks for muddying the waters. The remark is no doubt something that came from the AP article that was reposted by the American Family Association. And then there's another one. It's probably by the same writer, the same author, because the word Unitarian is misspelled in exactly the same way. U-N-I-T-A-T-I-A-N, Unitarian. The second post, also approved by the American Family Association. While this is a tragedy, the article may mislead those who are not familiar with the misspelled Unitarian non-religion. Unitarians are not Christians, and like all non-Christians, they're doing Satan's work. Almost word for word, a shorter version of the previous post. However, the American Family Association approved it. They liked the comment so much, they approved it twice. Now, the article I'm reading from, by the way, this is Mr. Jim Burraway over at Box Turtle Bulletin, who has been one of our wonderful guests here on the show, who is an expert in many things. Jim Burraway points out that we've lamented the resounding silence on the part of anti-gay religious activists concerning Larry King, and it looks like they've decided to come out from under the rocks, paraphrasing, and not to be so quiet this time, now that a gay-friendly church was the target. Jim Burraway points out that it is disgusting. And is it any wonder that Christians have such a bad name? After an hour or so, the American Family Association removed the second comment because it was pretty much a duplicate of the previous one. The truth is never hateful or an insult to those who mock the truth. Satan's stooges. Unitarians are not Christians. Christians and anyone who is not of Christ is of Satan. That is truth, not hate or insult. I just read you another comment, which was approved by the American Family Association. Unitarians are not Christians, and anyone who is not Christian is of Satan. That is truth, not hate or insult. You know, it's, Jim points out that at a time like this, we should be praying for people and not attacking them. I don't agree with their beliefs, but to insult them at this time does nothing to further the gospel of Christ. It only serves to give those who hate Christianity a reason to call us hateful. Bob and so many of the others have been pointing out that the shooter's library consisted of Sean Hannity and Michael Savage and Bill O'Reilly. I find it interesting that the police confiscated those materials as evidence from his home. And they also found right-wing books, which I don't know if these were all of the titles in the collection, but these are the big names that were given out. Brass knuckles, empty shotgun shells, handguns. Man claims that he did it because he needed to kill the liberals who were ruining the country. He again, on a separate occasion, said because of its liberal teachings and his belief that all liberals should be killed because they were ruining the country, he felt that Democrats had tied his country's hands on the war on terror, and they had ruined every institution in America with the aid of the media outlets, meaning, of course, the for-profit media, which we know the only possible way a person could come to an understanding like this, could come to this conclusion, would be because that person tunes into right-wing hate speech. All of his points for eliminating the people at that church were directly from right-wing radio and from the books he read. Yet there will be no fault pointed in that direction. He said he had to get the leaders of the liberal movement and that he would target those people. He said he couldn't get the leaders and he would target the people who had voted them into office. He expected to be killed during the assault. I guess he assumed that all the liberals there would be wussies and that he would be able to shoot them all. That was his plan, to shoot everyone. And he expected to be killed during the assault with a standoff to police. He was not expecting to get off his three or four shots and then be tackled to the ground by manly men who stood up for each other. This, I'm sure, came as a very big shock to the tottering old fool whose food stamps were about to be cut by the liberals, no doubt. The subtitles of the book, Liberalism is a Mental Health Disorder. That was Michael Savage. Let Freedom Ring by Sean Hannity. And, of course, Bill O'Reilly's monumental ego could only call his book after the name of the show, which is The O'Reilly Factor, and the book also called The O'Reilly Factor. He wrote a four-page letter, which he said many times stated the hatred of the liberal movement. Apparently it took him a week to write it. I'm not sure how that fact came to be known. The police chief said he fully expected to be killed on the site and to die as a hero, no doubt. And I'm sure he could hear in his mind, he could hear the Sean Hannitys and the Bill O'Reillys and the Rush Limbaughs and the Michael Savages praising him as an American hero for killing those who put the liberals in office. He probably felt that that was going to be very real, that he would become famous to the conservatives, who are, of course, the only representatives of God. Apparently the church had some, they were not, the church was not at all attempted to hide, they never attempted to hide the fact that they gays were welcome. They regularly ran announcements in the newspaper regarding meetings of parents, friends, and family of lesbians and gays, and the questioning youth meetings. All of it was freely talked about in the, the local newspaper. The announcements were there. In addition to that, his wife used to attend the church. I'm sure he, one of the reasons he threatened to kill her was the fact that she hung out with liberals. She had to take a restraining order out against him. He was concerned that the church has a gays welcome sign hanging at the door. The church website says that it works for desegregation, racial harmony, fair wages, women rights, and gay rights. The current ministry involves around emergency aid for the needy and school tutoring and support for the homeless, as well as a cafe that provides an alternative gathering place for gay and lesbian high schoolers. Now, the man who committed this act of terrorism doesn't appear to be a member of any church, but he was taught, well, you don't have to be a member of a church to tune in on the radio and find out what you're supposed to think. Although he did register to vote, that was in 2005 he registered to vote. I don't have to even make a guess regarding the political party he was affiliated with. And I can tell you that there will be no embarrassment amongst the Republicans in this country for being members of the same party that this man registered with. There's no embarrassment for the Republicans in this country to be a part of the same party of the Klan. No embarrassment whatsoever. So, Republicans will continue to walk holding their head up high regardless. Less than 24 hours after it occurred, one of the pro-family figures in the media announced publicly, less than 24 hours, that it proves hate crime protections are not needed because the media is going to prosecute it. This is, of course, an article regarding the man who pulled the trigger, the Adkison of Tennessee. This is Peter La Barbera, and he says, and I quote, "It proves our case that hate crime laws are not necessary." He said, "Americans for Truth About Homosexuality has been saying this all along." He says, "The media spotlight will now let everyone know that hate crimes are not necessary, that hate crime laws are not necessary." He says the mainstream media, or the media, in fact, will make sure that it gets the attention it deserves. And I may believe this man might get the death penalty without any help from the feds or any sort of hate prosecution. And, of course, it is Peter La Barbera and others like him who create the climate where hate crimes occur. This is what the truth wins out. Founder and executive director Wayne Benson has said. They're calling him a despicable opportunist who's barely waited for the police to draw a chalk line and wrap the tape around the crime scene before pushing his opposition to the hate crimes legislation. Again, this article summarizes the reasons that he did it. Liberals being the fault. It's our fault that all of the institutions in this country are failing, and because we have tied the country's hands in the war on terror. He also points out, this is Wayne Benson, who points out that the Unitarian Association of Congregations holds seven principles: the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, the goal of world peace and liberty and justice for all, and respect or the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We uphold the free search for truth. I think that every one of the listeners, and I'm sure all of the hosts, would completely agree with me when I lay this completely, this man's actions, I lay the responsibility at the feet of the right-wing radio crowd and the right-wing television crowd, although it will never be brought out. The New York Times did an article today called A Whole Lot of Ugly. You know, basically, they did this article called The Pastor of the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church occasionally wrote columns for the local newspaper, and last March he wrote one called Tolerance, in which he compared the past intolerance of interracial couples to today's intolerance of gay couples, and he pointed out in the movie Hairspray that the character Mabel warns a newly formed interracial couple, "You two better brace yourselves for a whole lot of ugly coming at you from a never-ending parade of stupid." And the New York Times goes on to decry the incident. Gay and lesbian issues like abortion have been tearing the nation apart, says an evangelical professor at Mercer University. And a woman echoes that thought and asks John McCain and Barack Obama why she's asking both, "I could not tell you," to bring an end to the culture wars. This woman is named Laser and is affiliated with a centrist think tank. Centrist is probably the reason both candidates are mentioned. One thinks that John McCain is attempting to heal the divides that are tearing this nation apart. Well, she says, "Senators McCain and Obama, each of you have great potential to model a new type of leadership. Each of you has the power to heal the country and carve a new path forward through our shared common values, not without the reining in of the right-wing ownership of the media. You don't." She says, "We humbly submit our joint prayers that you, Senator McCain and Obama, help bring end to the culture wars. Can't do that without winning the hearts and the minds of the people. And the minds of the people are owned by the right-wing media." Yes, they do. And I think I'm going to wrap up that coverage. We've heard a lot about it from all of the hosts on the network, and that's my small take on it. And I want a little bit of a story from the other side of some of the less talked about coverage. And again, we'll take a short break, and when we get back, we'll move on to other subject matter. This is Peter's Strictly Confidential Radio, and the telephone number is 877-443-2366. That's toll-free, 877, the number 4, head on. We'll be right back.
For many of us, coming out at work can be an act of incredible courage, especially if you live in one of the 33 states where it's legal to fire someone just for being gay.
They're allowed to come right up to me and say, "I'm sorry, but I found out you're a lesbian and you're fired."
But even those of us who are out and proud in supportive workplaces can run into problems. Matisha is a hairstylist who's in the closet at her salon, but she's worried her religious boss, Antoinette, is about to discover her secret. Laurel thought she had her dream job. She built a successful small business shooting action photos at a ski resort in gay-friendly Asheville, North Carolina. But when the resort's owner found out she was a lesbian, she was asked to leave.
"I lost my winter contract because I'm a lesbian."
Now she's a reluctant activist against discrimination, but the Christian right is organizing against her.
"We are here in support of the decision to dismiss two lesbians."
Can Laurel rise to the challenge and fight back in a role she never signed up for? Scott has just become the first out male police officer in the history of Montana.
How are you? I don't want to hit your little thing.
But increased visibility is bringing him increased hostility.
He walked into my life, and now he's taking over. And it's beautiful. Yes, it's beautiful. I've gone with better looking guys. He's gone with prettier looking girls. But now we're beautiful. I think we're beautiful. You really must agree together. We are beautiful. We are so beautiful. I am the rain, he is the sun. And now we've made a rainbow. I think it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. You really must agree together. We are beautiful. We are so beautiful. In love, just like me and my men, this would be beautiful. This would be so beautiful. I don't need love affairs anymore.
Track called Together We're Beautiful from the movie Kinky Boots. That's done by a fierce female impersonator. If you haven't seen Kinky Boots, you really should. It's an enchanting movie, and it's 2 hours of great fun. Kinky Boots. Let's go to Florida. It's near to me. In fact, I could look out the window if it were daylight and see Florida, but the others will have to teletransport. It's a good thing that in Holmes County being Panama City, the home of the young kid who was beaten to death in a boot camp, and also the home of Ponce de Leon High School, or as we say in the South, Ponce de Leon. In any case, The school board removed David Davis as the principal at Ponce de Leon High School, but they're allowing him to teach class as an instructor in government, and one wonders if this is the best place to put a man whose ignorance of constitutional rights costs the taxpayers, $325,000, yes, in legal fees. This is a story we covered a while back about the student who was outed and by the principal, and who the principal made a huge example of because she was a lesbian. But it's back in the news again because the judge has made his ruling. Now, in May, the U.S. District Judge ruled that the school board had violated a student's First Amendment freedom of speech when she was prohibited from wearing a T-shirt she had made supporting LGBT rights. But it wasn't the judge's full opinion. The full opinion was released just this past week, and that was a real smackdown to the Holmes County School Board. According to the facts section of the judge's opinions, the judge said that last September, a 12th grade student referred to as Jane Doe reported that she had been taunted by a group of middle school students, mind you, middle school students, because of her sexual orientation. Davis called her into his office and asked her, "Are you a lesbian?" And she answered, "Yes," whereupon Davis informed her it is not right to be homosexual. He then asked her, Jane Doe, that is, if her parents knew of her sexuality, and she said no, and Davis asked her for her parents' phone number so he could call them and inform them. He also instructed Jane to stay away from the middle school students or he would suspend her. Well, you understand that Jane being a high school student, the temptation of having middle school little girls around her would be impossible for any lesbian to resist because of their predatory nature. So he instructed her to stay away from the middle school teachers or he'd kick her out. So in short, Davis viewed Jane Doe as the guilty party. Now, the judge was also highly critical of how Davis handled the situation, which quickly spiraled out of control. When the students learned of Doe's predicament, several of them openly supported her and supported gay rights. These are high school students. And Davis, the principal at the time, responded by holding, are you ready for this, a morality assembly in which the entire high school was gathered together. At this morality assembly, Davis made it very clear that any gay-themed clothing and symbols were grounds for suspension. He told one of the suspended students' mother, and I quote, if there was a man in your house and your children were in church, you wouldn't be having any of these gay issues. The judge characterized Davis's actions as a witch hunt. So the judge went on to say that stifling the student's speech clearly ran afoul of established constitutional law and that Davis's behavior exceeded the bounds of professionalism. He did not protect a bullied student, and he overreacted by cracking down on any dissent, and the dissent was not disruptive to the learning environment. The judge also found that the high school in question is a typical high school with the usual amount of disagreements and distractions, and he concluded that most students are tolerant of other students regardless of their sexual orientation. The judge went on to say that homosexuality became an issue because the principal, Davis, made it the issue. The principal, the judge says, blamed Jane Doe, and all he had to do was tell her tormentors to leave her alone. But he singled her out as being the source of the problem, and he singled her out and told her that her political expression was not to be. Davis saw himself as a moral arbitrator and forgot that public school officials are obligated by laws that private schools are not. As a government representative, he and the board members are responsible for protecting everyone's rights, not just those they agree with. One wonders about him being appointed to teaching government after he was removed from the principal's position. He was replaced as a principal of this school, and He was offered an opportunity to work at the district office where he should have been put. If he had was not fired, he should at least be away from the students at the district office. Or he could return. He was given another choice. He could return to the classroom. And he chose to teach American government, of all things. So let's hope that he learned a valuable lesson. And that is just down the street in Panama City area. Amazing stuff. I think we've all heard the story of the Justice Department engaging in bias in terms of their hiring practices. It's been covered on NPR and most of the progressive blogs. And I've heard the story covered from the point of view of trying to find out if people were Republicans before they could be hired or promoted. But apparently there are examples of not just being Republican, but actual sexual orientation, specifically addressed by Monica Goodling, the university who's a graduate of the Regent University Law School, which was founded by televangelist Pat Robertson. You see, there's no need to obey any laws if you're a Christian, because, you know, if God's on our side, then the hell with you. Pretty much the way that logic goes. The Justice Department official violated federal non-discrimination laws by denying a job extension for a departmental attorney and attempting to block that attorney from obtaining two other department positions because she believed that the woman was a lesbian. This is Monica Goodling thinking that the woman was a lesbian, according to the findings of an internal Department of Justice investigation. The investigation found that Goodling, who was the senior counsel to Alberto Gonzalez and the department's liaison to the White House, told subordinates in 06 that she denied extending an appointment of former Assistant U.S. Attorney Leslie Hagan of Michigan to a post at the Justice Department because she disapproved of Hagan's sexual orientation. Now, the Justice Department says, we've concluded that Goodling's actions violated department policy and federal law and constituted misconduct. How this stuff keeps getting overlooked and overlooked and overlooked. You know, if you don't read it in the blogs or hear it on a program or any of the programs they have on Radio Network, the for-profit media will discard it. Poof, gone, never happened. And the crazy men will come out and shoot up churches. The findings involving Goodling's conduct toward Hagan were part of a broader year-long probe into the 06 firings of the 8 U.S. attorneys under Gonzalez. And, of course, Goodling resigned from the Justice Department in 07 amid allegations that she, imagine that, in other departments, individuals in the department helped orchestrate the U.S. attorney firings and used political and ideological considerations in hiring and firing dozens of career employees at the Department of Justice. There are questions asked like, why do you want to support a man like Bush, and who is the greatest politician? You've got all sorts of questions that determine your political leanings. And of course, in this article that we're covering now, the suspension of being a lesbian was way out of the rules of that particular game. Now, being a 1999 graduate of the Regent University Law School, she was part of a whole gaggle of young religious conservatives who joined the Bush administration in 2001, and it is indeed these people who have ruined everything in this country, as the shooter accused us of. In the discussion of the department's handling, the report states that investigators also found that Goodling told a number of subordinates that she believed Hagan was having a homosexual relationship with a female supervisor and that the two took trips together at government expense. And some of the subordinates who were interviewed in the investigation said Goodling told them Hagan was having a sexual relationship with the supervisor. The report carefully doesn't identify her by name, only as the assistant U.S. attorney, but she also holds the name of the person whom Goodley said that Hagen was having the sexual relationship with. Now, both of them denied it. They were told, the assistant U.S. attorney Hagen told us that the rumors were false and that she was not involved in a sexual relationship with her U.S. attorney. And the U.S. attorney also denied that she was having any sort of sexual involvement with the other person. So that's significant, in as much as now that they've been vindicated, there's no longer any need to deny it. Goodling made sure that the person was not reinstated to her job. That's Hagen. She said the 2006 performance appraisal, which covered in detail, rated her performance as outstanding on all of the elements, and she received the highest possible ratings. But Goodling made it known that she wanted her terminated from the post and didn't want her to be considered for any other Justice Department jobs, and made sure to make entries into her personnel file that would prevent her from being hired anywhere else. So that's just a little information to tell you some more about some of the things that Goodling, the graduate from Regent University, was trying to accomplish there. You know, in Washington State, we talk about so many things here that progressives just don't do. Liberals don't burst into churches and shoot people because they're conservative, although God knows it's a temptation. But we just don't do that because we are civilized people and we get it. Neither do progressives take a car key or something sharp and deface other people's cars in their driveways because they have political signs in their yard that they don't agree with. A Vancouver, Washington woman had a Barack Obama sign in her yard, and that was all that it took to set off some sleaze bags to key her car in the driveway of her home. The words "White Power" and "I'm Gay" were etched into the car last Saturday. The woman had left her car in the driveway of her home when the vandal struck. She filed a report with the Vancouver police, and what was in her yard was a blue "Elect Obama" sign. That's all it said, which is what caused the crime to happen. She says that Clark County has its share of unrepentant bigots. Earlier this year, the son of a battleground county council member was charged with cyber stalking over a racist emails that were sent to a black council member and other community members. So it's just not acceptable to just sort of shrug off racist defacement of property as being just kids. These are things that are learned at home. These are okay things to do if you're standing up for white folks and heterosexuality. I think this is getting pretty tiresome to all of us, hearing news like that. Did you hear about California? There's an anti-gay marriage group who is very upset with Jerry Brown for twisting their words, and they're taking him to court for it. You see, supporters of the ballot measure, which would ban gay marriage, to amend the Constitution to say that marriage is between a man and a woman and is the only relationship that's valid in California. Well, last week, Brown's office changed Proposition 8's ballot title to say that the measure seeks to eliminate the right of same-sex couples to marry. And the Project Marriage Coalition spokeswoman, Jennifer Kearns, called the new language inherently argumentative and said it would prejudice voters against the initiative. And so she has filed a lawsuit. The original wording of the proposition amends the California, it says, Proposition 8 amends the California Constitution to provide that only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized. And the new language says that Proposition 8 changes California Constitution to eliminate the right of same-sex couples to marry, and further explains that banning gay marriage could prevent the state from gaining tens of millions of dollars in potential sales tax revenue. Well, now, the activists think that the language spells out the removal of an existing right for same-sex couples could help defeat the measure. But in fact, this is the case now. When the initiative was first written, there was no right to marry. And now that it exists, the amendment is not to maintain the fact that only men and women can marry. It will remove the right that already exists, which apparently is going to be difficult for the voters to take away a right. It seems more drastic. It's not as appealing than to keep the status quo. You know, the status quo is so important to so many people. The removal of rights may add up to 10 percentage points to the no vote. And, of course, no one in California wants to take away money, considering the sorry state of affairs that's happening at this point in time in the country in general. And, by the way, California is going to have some competition coming up here very soon from Massachusetts regarding the, my God, how the money rolls in for marriage. You know, so many people are booking their plane tickets to head to California to get married, because in California you can marry if you're not a resident. Well, that wasn't the case in Massachusetts until today. Today the bill passed. As soon as the governor signs the bill, which he's already said he would, then same-sex couples from out of state are going to be able to get married in Massachusetts. The bill that passed today repeals the 1913 law, and it's on its way to the governor. He's going to sign it. The 1913 law came along to prevent interracial marriage back in the day, and it was gleefully pounced upon by the right-wingers when marriage between same-sex couples became legal in California, that, in fact, this 1913 law would prevent couples from out of state from marrying. The law read that couples are not allowed to marry. If they're not allowed to marry in their home state, then they cannot get married in Massachusetts. So now Massachusetts is, and quite rightly, removed the law. Of course, money was part of it. It's difficult to sit back and watch California raking in all the dough, and all you have to do is repeal a 1913 law. So I imagine that many people from the state of New York will be canceling their plane tickets and jumping on Amtrak and heading over to Massachusetts. So Massachusetts is now in that game and stands to make millions of dollars from wedding cakes and caterers and DJs and all the people who participate in pulling together a wedding. In fact, the estimates, many people have said the estimates are low in terms of the amount of money that the state can make, because many of the estimates don't include the crowd that comes with the couple. You know, the hotel bookings for the mother and father and the aunts and the uncles and the friends and all the folks that typically come along with the wedding. So, in fact, I'm proud to say that now we can get married in Massachusetts also, even if we don't live there, which I just think is absolutely fabulous. So what we're going to do is take a top-of-the-hour break, just a little bit late. And by the way, at the bottom of the hour, we have VJC from disco935.net in New York is our DJ at the gay bar across the street, which I'm looking forward to his segment tonight. It kicks off with some tracks by Cerrone, which is one of my all-time favorites, and I had requested those from VJC, and in fact, he came through. So at the top of the hour or shortly after, we'll run a short break, and we'll be back. This is Peter. This is Strictly Confidential.
My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of our children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
And he's back, riding across America on a horse named Strictly Confidential, a man who knows his way around a pair of chaps. Here's your host, Peter Godbold.
And indeed, riding across the country on a horse named the Head On Radio Network, this is Peter Godbold. This is Strictly Confidential, and you are listening to the Tuesday evening edition. We have Victor VJC coming up in a little while with the Gay Bar Across the Street segment from the Paradise Dance Hall. And we have a very short track I'm going to try to fit in before that was sent in by a listener, which is it's a very short track, and I've been looking for a way to fit it in. I hope we can run it for you this evening, a great little track called Debbie. And, see, it's called Rufus and Beverly. Debbie, where did I get that? Lord knows where I got that one. In any case, I'm going to tell you a little story here, and I promise, please don't start throwing eggs and tomatoes at me. I'm not going to launch into a huge speech about Bush and the library again. I may bring up the library from time to time because it's an affront to us all, the think tank, to rewrite George Bush's history. But as I told you the other evening, it is a done deal. Now, when I told you that, I was aware of this fact, but I thought that I should go ahead and mention it to you should you come across it in your reading and think that that I didn't present the whole story. But this, it in fact, is a done deal. It's just the people who are trying to stop the library from the Methodist Church have to unturn every single rock and try everything. There's one last thing that is being tried. And that is a long-shot appeal, meaning it will never happen, to block the SMU's plans for the George Bush Library Complex. Now, if you remember, I told you the story. The South Central jurisdiction endorsed the decision to lease the land to Southern Methodist, to the George Bush Project at Southern Methodist University. And so the delegate sent the matter to the church's highest lawmaking body. Now, so what's been happened is the Judicial Council has been asked to examine SMU's leasing of the land below market value for the Public Policy Institute, which is part of the Presidential Library Complex. And the question is whether or not the actions meet SMU's church rules, which require that campus buildings be used for educational or religious purposes only. And she said the lease, as it exists, would subsidize a specific political and ideological point of view. Now, this has been submitted. The decision will come back in 30 days. The council meets in October. So there is no hope on this. The university entered into a 99-year lease for the Bush Foundation for a total of $1,000 to 99 years, well below market value. And, of course, the institution is not going to be used for anything educational. But I wanted to point out to you that, in fact, I reported that it was a done deal, and in my mind and in everyone's mind, it is a done deal. The Southern Methodist University has indeed sold its soul to the devil, but this is the very last possible legal maneuver that the opponents can use, and so they are taking it. They must do that so that no one could ever say to them that you didn't try everything. But, in fact, the George W. Bush think tank and library will be located at Southern Methodist University. I believe construction will start in 2010, and it should be completed, and all of the books, one crate, should be moved in by 2012, and of course there will be an exhibit there to the codpiece that George W. Bush wore on the fake warship at sea set that was set up. You know, after 6 years of incompetence and cronyism, failed war against terrorism, which is not a person, place, or, well, maybe a thing. This thing we call a rock, wars against science, wars against the environment, corporate regulation, the public rights to know, chummy working relationship with the country's most reactionary, conservative, evangelical Christians, politicized faith-based initiative, giveaways to the energy industry, tax relief for the wealthy, Lord, it's the list. A culture of corruption culminating in the forced resignations and imprisonment of some of the administration's key high-ranking individuals, the attack on the fundamental democratic rights and values. And having said all of that, the Bush administration is going to complete its plans to celebrate itself with a $500 million library. By the way, it's the costliest presidential library ever to be built. It'll be built at the end of Bush's second term. Now, it's being called their final campaign, by the way. The Bush's truest believers are aiming to raise $500 million for what they call the mother of all presidential libraries. The library and the attached think tank will pay for conservative research, whatever in the hell that is, and it's going to be at Southern Methodist University, where Laura Bush, bag lady, and by bag lady I mean she sold bags of dope, is an alumni and a trustee. Inside Higher Education recently pointed out that Southern Methodist had been competing for the library with Baylor. Baylor wisely backed out when they realized that it was that they were told behind the scenes that it was a done deal for SMU and they might as well give up. They've torn down condominiums. They've torn down people's homes to make room for the land. They're being sued by some of the condominium owners. And, of course, when it was leaked that the library was coming, when it was finally leaked to the ministers and the lay people, this is when people began complaining. But it's all over, but the writing, the fat lady has sung. Southern Methodist University no longer has any credibility whatsoever and ranks right up there with the Regent University as being a high quality. It's shameful. But, you know, I've ranted on that so many nights. But I did want to point out to you that indeed the party is over, but there is one last step should you come across that and you're exploring. The Bush racers are hoping to get $500 million of what they call mega donations, $10 to $20 million a pop. According to the Daily News, Bush loyalists have already identified wealthy Harrises, Arab nations, and captains of industry as potential mega donors and are pressing for full formal announcement, which is now expected early in the new year. The rest of the cash is going to come from donors willing to pay $25,000 to $5 million. And the donors to the library are going to remain anonymous. In February 06, the Associated Press reported that among the donors, there's a sheikh from the United Arab Emirates who contributed at least $1 million, the state of Kuwait, various sultans and family of the Oman, King Hussein, you know, all the likely suspects. China gave tens of thousands of dollars to the library, chump change. In fact, I think that tens of thousands of dollars is almost an insult coming from China. Funds were received from Ken Lay and Enron and Dick Cheney, stolen money, of course. The Daily News says that libraries are run by the National Archives and Records Administration, but, of course, the Bush records are sealed in perpetuity, and the think tank is completely free from any control of Southern Methodist University. So I'm one of the ones who regret to see that SMU enshrine these attitudes, and I am one of the ones who will tell you, quite frankly, this will be a huge embarrassment to the United Methodist Church for many years to come. It is the equivalent of the Catholic Church having the George Wallace Library located there. Or worse. It's hard to think of worse, but nonetheless. We are going to start Victor's Gay Bar Across the Street segment soon, but this is a great little track that was sent in by one of our listeners, Fancy Free. You know her in the chat room as Fancy Free. And it's a cute little track she found called Rufus and Beverly, a short one. So, Bob, if you'll run that, we should have just enough time to run that, and we'll hit the gay bar across the street. Rufus and Beverly.
Rufus could play the piano, and he drove an American car. He worked 9 to sundown in an office downtown to save us from nuclear war. Beverly came from Seattle, with an mouth harp quite well, so they said.
say. She used to write songs in an old-timey style in hope she could sell them someday. Well, Rufus and Bev became sweethearts, and nature could not be denied. They did the things lovers do under the covers, as happy as clams at high tide. One morning said Rufus to Beverly, as they lay in the fondest embrace, here I have to confess with some minor distress, there's an issue I fairly must face. For this body you see here before you was once more like yours than like mine, and I sought the compliance of medical science to change to the sex masculine. Beverly stared back in silence and said, Rufus, don't rue what you've done, for I have surrendered a masculine gender for this other more feminine one. These lovers turned back to their passion, and their passions were scarcely diffused, and the knot they soon tied, although deep down inside, they were ever so slightly confused.
And that, my friends, is Rufus and Beverly. A nice little ukulele piece. I suppose that's as close to transgendered folk music as we're going to come. Surely there's. We need to talk to our friends over at Trans FM. We had a guest from Trans FM. I'd love to have him back. He was an interesting guest. And Trans FM is a great. By the way, just Google it. Trans FM. If the Head On Radio Network is streaming replays and you'd like to hear something really, really, really different, Google Trans FM. And you're going to find shows there that will just knock your little head off because they come from an entirely different point of view of the LGBT community. Just before we bring Victor on, I want to ask a couple of questions about what if. You know, these are typical. What I'm about to give you are typical remarks of the American, the fundamentalist right. America is no longer good. Unrighteousness, evil, corruption, perversion, death are now standard operating procedure in this godless United States of America. Now, can you just imagine the uproar if a liberal politician began calling America evil and predicting its demise? My stars, would be labeled as anti-American and contemptible, and that they were going to hell, and that all left-leaning people are basically fundamentally moral corrupt. And, you know, these days, if you just say you weren't mistreated by the Iraqis, that's enough to get you called a suicide bomber. But it is quite A-OK when a right-wing Christian complains about the evil in this country. It's amusing that the whining from those who claim to be an oppressed minority, who lately seem to be coming up at a consistent 25%, 25% are going to vote for, well, you know, it's a state. It's suddenly become from a huge majority reliably day after day after day, it's reported as 25%. These people are not a minority. They are a majority. They never were. The mainstream media has lied to you. Surprise, surprise. The for-profit media has told you a story to rearrange the balance of power. Now, it's fundamentalist theology. It's when it's convenient for them, the U.S. is the light of the world and it's going to bring democracy and peace to the world. But when it's convenient to them, the U.S. is corrupt and it has a culture that is a war against the LGBT community and a war against Christians, depending on which side of that ticket you're on. Of course, this crap gets lots of mileage with the working class who, by virtue of their cultural economic position, have suffered from lazy study and perhaps underfunded school systems who do not teach civics, and they're not educated about the most fundamental principles of democracy. We lament time and time again. They know the winners of Star Search, but they do not know the branches of government. So the Christian fundamentalists have picked up the ball and left these people confused and frustrated. They do this by giving them a plethora, a virtual army of easy answers to complex questions and the impetus to never question those easy answers, because if you just accept those easy answers, it's going to be better for everyone. Yet they remain 25% consistently. What in the hell is Nancy Pelosi afraid of is what I would like to ask. Tomorrow evening's show hopefully be a little bit better organized than this. This is not one of my most organized. I try to weave things together a little smoother normally, but it was one of those afternoons I was fighting a computer and finally gave up and went to a laptop for chat. But I was thrown off just a little bit, but hey, you know, it's strictly confidential, so you won't tell anybody, I know. Tomorrow night we'll talk about, depending on how long our guest is with us, we'll talk about Troy King and the huge salaries he's paying to the hot stud aides. He pays well for sex. Oh, he pays very well for sex. We'll talk about it tomorrow. But right now, it is time for us to gather our parasols and our little umbrellas and our pocketbooks and our boas and our leather chaps and head on over to the gay bar across the street where Victor VJC is
across
playing
the alley was
tonight.
The Paradise Dance Hall. Evenings in spring, they'd open all the doors and windows and the music would come outside. Sometimes they'd turn out all the lights except for a large glass sphere that hung from the ceiling. It would turn slowly about and filter the dusk with delicate rainbow colors.
Hello, it's VJC for the Disco Flight and Strictly Confidential Radio's Peter Godball. Kick it off with Sharon's Trippin' on the Moon. And Peter, you requested this, you got it. Inside the Mix, yours truly, VJC. Enjoy the ride of 70s, 80s disco and beyond. It's nonstop commercial free.
true self.
Yeah, the sound of Sharon, the collector. It's a disco flight with yours truly, BJC. Hello, Peter, what's up? Samaria, Alex Constantino production, Golden Tears. We continue non-stop, commercial free. It's a disco flight with yours truly, BJC. Hello. We'll be right back. and Don Ray, Midnight Madness. It's a disco flight with yours truly, BJC. Hello.
And as a quick reminder for the upcoming schedules, I need to let you know that tomorrow evening we have author John Simpson, who writes gay fiction. He'll be the second in our series of gay fiction writers. Coming up next week will be the amazing Amuka. Amuka is a club diva with a story to tell. She will be Thursday the 7th. Following that, we will have none other than Lucy Neal. Lucy Neal has done everything from Singin' Hair to Silver Connection to Roberta Kelly. She's done it all. It's going to be an amazing story with Lucy Neal. She'll be coming up on August the 14th. All of these are on a Thursday. Glenn has us fully booked with high quality and exceptional music guests for the next few weeks. Again, this is Strictly Confidential. Peter Godbold. We're not planning on doing a horn section this evening. I've got a scratchy voice, and I'm gonna turn it in. And John is tied up in a business meeting and won't be available for the horn section or his all foxed up, which runs at midnight. So this will be the end of the live programming for this evening. We will be back tomorrow night. I'll have a guest. I'm not sure what Bob has up his sleeve, but as we all know, it's always fabulous when Bob is on the air. Please join Bob from 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. Eastern on the Head On Radio Network. You don't know what you're missing. I beg of you to do that. So having said all of that, in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you too.